Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
This is the Chuck and Julie Show. Chuck and Julie are down in Phoenix, Arizona. Well, actually, I don't know if they're in Phoenix. I'm assuming they are, but they're down in Arizona, hopefully playing golf and having a great time, taking a little vacation, which they much deserve. So this is Mark Poff, your guest host for the day. So, you know, I figured that something was going to happen. I always joke with Chuck and Julie that, you know, I can announce, hey, we're going to talk about this, and then something's going to happen that will probably change that up. I'm sure they're used to doing the same thing. So, of course, today, this morning, there was a shooting up in Denver. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And also, Donald Trump is still a free man. He's not been indicted, and that seems to be taking some bizarre twists. So I want to talk a little bit about that at first, and kind of some of my knowledge about grand juries and how some of that works and what's going on there. And then John and I, in a little bit when he joins in, we'll talk about, is the judicial system fair for all people? And we'll talk about some of the cases that we've worked on, not specifically, we're not going to name the cases, but just talk about some of the things we've seen since we've been working for defense attorneys in some of these cases. I actually had one just, I mean, literally today that I thought was just crazy. What a prosecutor was doing, but we'll talk about that probably about 20 or 25 minutes after the hour. So talking about Donald Trump a little bit, President Trump, I should give him that title because he is a former president of the United States. So, you know, Trump's always been good about kind of calling people out from the standpoint of, okay, if you're going to keep messing with me and saying that you're going to do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to call you out to do it, kind of call your bluff. And it appears that Trump's kind of called this Alvin Bragg's, called him out, called his bluff and said, hey, if you're going to do this, do this. And today it appears that he's having a little disgruntled employees or people on the grand jury. Now, I find this very ironic because I know from previous experience on some cases, I'm familiar with the Terry Makita case, which is a sheriff down here in El Paso County, a former sheriff of El Paso County, that was indicted after he left office. And it was a complete travesty. You know, as a cop for 18 years, 17 years, and a detective for 10 years working on major cases, I worked over 100 death investigations. You know, I know the law pretty well. I teach the law down at Pikes Peak State College. So I think I'm pretty well versed of what the Colorado law is. And what they brought, the law, the charges against Terry Makita were ridiculous. Basically, they wanted to charge him for official misconduct because he was questioning a contractor, a medical contractor in the jail that was providing services to inmates. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, it's the sheriff's responsibility to make sure that the jail is a safe and secure environment for not only the inmates, but for employees. And they tried to say that he was guilty of official misconduct by calling out individuals that he thought were not being safe or providing the services that the county was paying for. That's official misconduct. So that was ridiculous. They tried to charge him for kidnapping on a case that was just absurd and false imprisonment. That whole thing fell right on its face. There was no conviction of former Sheriff Terry Makita. Well, they're trying to do it on a larger scale, but think about this. What if a local DA from Denver, you know, tried to charge former President Donald Trump on something that was trumped up that other people had looked at and said, you know, hey, there's no way that we would do this. Federal prosecutors, which are typically the best of the best, passed on it and said, you know what, there's just not enough there to do anything. We don't think it's a crime. We're not doing this. So it's been years ago that this supposedly took place after the statute of limitations. So you have this Alvin Bragg, a local district attorney, trying to indict a former president who's now residing in another state on a misdemeanor that he's trying to somehow finagle it into a felony, which I don't completely understand that, and is trying to indict him by going through a grand jury. Of course he's going to go through a grand jury, because like I've said numerous times, you can indict a ham sandwich in a grand jury. If you understand how the rules are in a grand jury, the defense can't come in. Donald Trump can't have some attorneys come in or witnesses on his behalf and say, look, I want you to listen. I want the grand jury to hear my witnesses. That doesn't happen. It's completely controlled by the district attorney that's running this grand jury. So he basically gets to show them what he wants them to see. So if you can't get an indictment from a grand jury, you have a serious problem, because you're the one saying, here's the cards I want you to see, and these are the only cards you're going to be able to see. And then the grand jury members are saying, you know, I just don't know if that's enough. So the rumor is today that's out on the news is that Alvin Bragg, the DA for Lower Manhattan or whatever, is having trouble getting a majority of the members of this grand jury to buy off on these charges. If that's true, he needs to let it go. This is going to be so embarrassing for him, because if he does convince these people into doing an indictment against former President Donald Trump, it's going to backfire on the whole thing. I mean, the things that have so obviously are being exposed from this is he doesn't care what's fair. This is obviously highly political on what he's doing. And I have found from my experience down in El Paso County, whenever you try to indict people for political gain, it typically backfires on you. I think Alvin Bragg knows this isn't going to play out well, but he made a campaign promise. And I think he made promises to other political figures. And what if that gets out, that we find out that he made promises to the DNC or whatever, that, you know, hey, you know, help me get elected as the DA in Manhattan, and I will take down Donald Trump for you. So I think there's so much going on here. I think they want that picture of Donald Trump in a mugshot. I think they want to handcuff him, which is another thing that really bothers me. Even in the state of Colorado, you can do what's called a felony summons, and this has to be approved by the local DA, Alvin Bragg. So what he could do is say, look, you don't even have to come up from Florida. Just have your attorney appear. We'll do the paperwork. You know, he can sign on your behalf or whatever. And they wanted to do it virtually on a video system, you know, so they know that they're talking to Donald Trump. There's no reason that they need a mugshot. I think we pretty much know what Donald Trump looks like. And I don't think we really need to be handcuffing Donald Trump. And I'm still trying to figure out how that would work out with the Secret Service, armed Secret Service agents. So the whole thing is just a joke. It's ridiculous. I think it's going to backfire. I think it's, you know, one of the reasons Donald Trump got elected back in 2016 is that he got all this free media, and here they are going to do it again. They're going to give him all kinds of free media attention. So I think the whole thing is stupid. I am kind of interested to see how it plays out, because again, I think it just is that stupid. So we'll see how that plays out with Donald Trump. I'm sure Chuck and Julie will cover that extensively, and they'll know a lot more about it than I do. I'm just trying to come from a retired detective's point of view that the whole thing just seems absurd to me. So up in Denver, we had a shooting this morning, and I was watching the news about this, and I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting when they started laying out the scenario. I was on the Lewis Palmer District 38 School Board for almost 12 years. So I'm very well versed on being on a school board. I've been in every position on the school board all the way up to president. I was president for 2 terms when I was on the school board. So I know what it's like to run a school board. So the main thing that a school board does is they do resolutions. That's kind of how we operate as a school board. You basically do a resolution and you direct the superintendent to implement your desires, if you want to call it that, your wishes or your instructions. And the school board should be following their clients, if you want to call them clients, or man, it's interesting that I forgot all this stuff since getting off the school board, but the residents of the community. So a couple of years ago, Denver's pretty liberal, unfortunately, the school board bought into this whole defund the police. And even whether you buy into this or don't buy into it, you got to understand, as a school board member, it's your first job or role is you've got to protect the kids. It's very important that the kids can get an education in a safe and secure environment. So now, obviously, I would tell you my views, being on a school board for 12 years, is I didn't want any politics or religion in the schools at all. So I wanted the kids to basically just be educated and keep all that other stuff out of the school system and let the kids figure it out for themselves using their family and friends to determine their opinions, their views, or whatever. I wanted all of it out. But here you have people that are highly publicized or political individuals that are in school board roles up in Denver. So shortly during all this defund the police baloney, they came up with a resolution, and this directly affects what happened this morning at the shooting. And I'm going to go into a little more detail here in a minute about the shooting. But this resolution, they touted it as, you know, this great thing. And this resolution basically boots out school resource officers out of Denver Public Schools. Now, do we think this is a good idea or a bad idea? I think it's absolutely a stupid idea. You need a safe and secure environment. You need law enforcement in your schools so they can work with the kids. And I would tell you from my standpoint, having been, you know, in law enforcement, you want the kids to feel comfortable interacting with law enforcement, that you can go up and talk to them. It's the guy that we know. They all here, they all called him Dennis because they knew where our school resource officer was in Lewis Palmer. And then he ultimately, when he retired from law enforcement, he became the head of security at District 38. What a great transition from being an SRO and then heading up our security. But in a resolution, you state facts first, and then you say, whereas, and these are supposed to be facts. Then you say, therefore, be it resolved. And that is, this is how we're going to answer these facts. Because of these facts, we're going to do this. So in this resolution, they say that because of they want to protect, it is DPS, Denver Public Schools, responsibility or obligation to protect our kids from the impact of systemic racism to the greatest extent possible while they're at school. So they're saying it's their responsibility to protect the kids from racism, systemic racism. Then they say down here from 2014 to 2019, approximately 5 years, that DPS students were ticketed or arrested by police officers, their SROs, at least 4,500 times, with the vast majority being Black or Latinx. I guess that's some new term. I thought it was Latino students between the ages of 10 and 15, thereby introducing them to the criminal justice system and often inflicting institutional trauma. So by arresting someone who breaks the law, even though they're a juvenile, it's the cop's fault, and you're inflicting them with trauma. Mental trauma is what they're saying in this resolution. And they're stating this as a fact. So this is whereas this is true. Then they say to perpetuation of the school to prison pipeline is incompatible with our goal of creating safe, healthy, and equitable schools for our students. So they're saying that by having SROs in their school, you're creating a school-to-prison pipeline that is inconsistent with their goals. Well, maybe it should be teaching responsibility to the kids to the point where they don't want to go to jail. I know when I went to school, I didn't think about doing anything like this because I didn't want the impacts of getting arrested. I mean, whether you're a juvenile or an adult, getting arrested is not a good thing, but we want to get rid of this. Now, understand, if you get rid of your SROs, are the number of arrests going to go down? Yes. And therefore, they can say, see, when we got rid of our SROs, we didn't have as many arrests, so our schools are safer. No, it's because you're not enforcing any of the laws. You're trying to handle it all in the schools instead of letting law enforcement deal with crime. And they actually said, I watched where they had a work session, and it's a good thing, you know, that they were doing it virtual, so you can go back and watch these work sessions online, where they actually talk about the fact that they want to handle this stuff in school. They don't want these kids to be arrested and things like that. So it just doesn't, to me, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. And they're saying in here that they could also handle things more effectively inside with school personnel. All right, so here's what they're saying that they're going to do. So everything I just read up to this point was what they state as facts. Because of this, we need to do something. That's why we're going to have this resolution and direct the superintendent to get rid of all of our SROs. So it says, so therefore be it resolved to fulfill its responsibility for undoing the systemic racism that Black children and children of color face. The Board of Education directs the superintendent to get rid of the SROs. Now, I'm shrinking that down because I don't want to read all this stupid crap. So what the Denver Public Schools said is it's our responsibility for undoing systemic racism of our Black and children of color at our school districts. So to help get rid of systemic racism, we've got to get rid of the SROs. So what are they saying? What is Denver Public School Board saying? They're saying that cops are racist and we're not going to, you know, affect our kids with racist cops. So they just said that's what they're going to do. So how is that working out for them? So let's kind of review what happened today. So this morning they had a shooting. All right, we have a shooting. Thank goodness no kids were hurt. Two staff members were shot and one pretty seriously. So hopefully, you know, we hope and pray that both of these dean of students, these faculty members are okay. So what were they doing when this shooting happened? They were searching, or by their terms, they were patting down a student to see if he had weapons. Okay, my first question would be, why are you having a staff member who's not part of security, a dean of students, why are you having them pat down a student? Then they said this was a daily occurrence. And I'm like, what? What do you mean a daily occurrence? So he was in a safety plan. So this student was in a safety plan so he could continue to go to high school at East High School up in Denver. Every day he had to go to the front office or something. It sounded like he went to the office and somebody patted him down to make sure that he didn't have weapons. Well, was that student allowed to come on the premises of the school property until he went in and said, okay, it's my daily search, go ahead and search me? Makes no sense whatsoever to have a daily pat down to be part of a safety program or safety plan for that student. If a safety plan for a student is that he needs to be patted down for weapons every day, what the hell is he doing on school property? What did he do to deserve that they've got to check him every day to make sure he doesn't have weapons? And what about the safety of all the other students? I get that you want to have every student come in, but for God's sakes, if this student is having that much of an issue that the safety for the rest of the school requires that staff pats him down every day before he can go to class, that's insane. And also, you don't have any SROs there. And I mean, I would question, again, if he needs to be patted down every day, that's crazy. But why are you having regular staff? What happens when they find a gun? Uh-oh. I'm thinking maybe what happened this morning is they either found the gun or he got fed up with being patted down every morning. So he pulls out a gun and he starts shooting them. They're not trained to handle that. They're not law enforcement. They're not security. They're deans of student. They're faculty members that are being asked to act in a security role, to pat down a student every day. And one of them or both of them have now been seriously injured because of this stupid, insane policy that this school district came up with. You've got, guess who's suing? These two dean of students they can retire because they're now going to get boatloads of money. Because where is that in their job description that they have to pat down students? That's why you have security. That's why you have SROs. So I'm interested to see what the parents are going to do after this, because I would tell you, if I was a parent, I don't care if I was conservative or liberal, this doesn't make any sense to me that a safety plan for multiple students, and I believe the superintendent said today, oh, this has been going on for a while, very safe until it happened to happen, you know, it happened today. Does that sound like the old phrase, a mostly peaceful protest? Hey, 95% of the time it works out when we pat down these kids, but 5% it goes south. It can't go south at all. You've got to protect all the kids, not the privacy or whatever of just a few kids. that are putting so much risk to the school system that they needed to be patted down every day. That's just crazy. They also have an interview with the chief of police of Denver Police Department, where he says, yes, there should be SROs in every one of these schools. Absolutely, they should. Understand how much training. I mean, I remember my training when I worked in law enforcement. We went through training all the time. Then you have SROs who get specialized training for schools. These dean of students, they don't get that kind of training. They're not security personnel. So this whole process just amazes me. I can't wait to sit back and watch to see how this plays out. It just amazes me that they think that this is a good idea. And another thing that's interesting is back when I was on the school board, I always referenced, you know, maybe we should have an active shooter drill. And everyone was like, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that. You know, our parents will freak out. I said, well, you know, we go through fire drills once or twice a year with our students, and we haven't lost a kid to a school fire in 50 years, not one student in 50 years, probably longer than that. But we're losing kids, you know, to gun violence, if you want to call it that, but to school shootings. So you need to have a plan. You need to be able to get the kids to understand you'll traumatize the kids. Now, let me tell you something. Being shot at is going to give our kids trauma. Having a plan that if something does go south and it can happen at any school is a lot better, that the kids know what to do and that the staff knows what to do. Make sure you have security. One of the worst signs that you can ever see at a school district, and you'll see it everywhere, is a gun-free zone. You know, you see that old sign saying, you know, this is a school, gun-free zone. You know what they might as well put up there? Soft target. This is where you want to come and start shooting people because nobody here has guns. So I made sure when I was on the school board at Lewis Palmer School District, that right next to that sign that says gun-free zone, it says armed security on premise. So they see two things. They say, yeah, nobody is supposed to have guns here, but we do. We have armed security. We have SROs. We have guns. So if you come into our school property with a weapon, you're going to receive return fire from our people. So that's one of the things that really kind of gets me is from the standpoint of school boards are, they're going to get sued over this, and they're going to get sued a lot, and they're going to pay out on this, and they're going to realize they're stupid, just like San Francisco city council members that are now saying, where's all the cops? Where's all the cops? Well, it's because you defunded them, you dumbass. You know, so they need to understand that, that they're stupid. So we're going to see how this plays out. I'm interested to watch it. But that's enough about our schools. And I should have, if you could bring on John St. Augustine, I think he's on board at this point. He probably doesn't want to do all the political stuff, so I'm going to have to tone down my politics. But John, I wanted to see if you wanted, one of the things I want to say is John St. Augustine was asked to do a Columbine reinvestigation of the shooting for Columbine. So John is very familiar with school shootings, school safety. He's an expert in these areas. So I wanted to give him an opportunity before we move on to the judicial system. Is there anything, John, that you would like to add when we come to school safeties, anything like that?
Well, thanks again, Mark, for having me on. I just caught the end of your rant. Yeah, your rave. Yeah, your rant and rave. You know, the one thing that is interesting, if you look at just the kind of the history in the last year there in Denver, Denver East, I don't know if you knew this, but just this last month in February, there was a kid who was killed, Luis Garcia. He was parked, I think, on the north side of the campus or someplace off of campus. He was killed. And back in September, so in this school year, they've already had two shootings. This is now the third school shooting since the beginning of the school year. And I mean, you know, the whole school board thing, I believe, came up in 2020. So, you know, what you got to look at, you know, is if you got these school shootings that are going on, what are you doing to prevent it from happening? Right. I mean, if you have a kid who's been shot in the face, a kid who's been killed, and now you have two, you know, faculty members, administrators who've been now shot at. One is my understanding is in serious and critical condition. The other one is in stable condition. You know, regardless of whether they live or die, the reality is that you have violence that's going on in your school. And the bottom line is you have to do something to stop that. And if you don't have law enforcement available on the campus, I mean, let's face it, student resource officers is a line of defense, right? It's, you know, in layman's terms, it's the lights that are on in your residence, right? It's a line of prevention. It's something that gives awareness. Like that, if that kid knew that there were student resource officers there who were armed, the likelihood of him wanting to pull out a gun and try and engage is a lot less than knowing that he's confronting somebody who's not armed at all, right? Who's not trained at all. And as you said, right, you're asking somebody who, you know, the dean of schools is more of a disciplinary role, right? They're just supposed to, you know, be there and provide some kind of disciplinary action when a student messes up, whether it's academically, right, athletically, whether there's, you know, something going on in that school. They're the enforcer, but they're not the law enforcement. That's not their role. And so I think there's, you know, if this isn't an eye opener, it should be an eye opener for the current administration to say, you know what, we've had now four people who have been hurt in three different shootings. We've got to do something different. And if we don't, right, our exposure is great because, you know, at the end of the day, they are looking at what their liability is going to be. And as you said, Mark, right. I mean, there's probably going to be a number of lawsuits that are going to come out of this.
From their own faculty.
From their own faculty, yeah. You know,
I mean, you have to protect your staff just as much as you do your students.
Well, yeah, you
guarantee the students are going to say that they don't feel safe. And if you actually listen, sorry for
that's okay.
Give you a chance to talk, no. But I watched their meeting where they were talking about getting rid of the SROs, and they talk about this holistic point of view of, you know, it's just not, we don't want to just react to the symptoms, you know, which is shootings. We don't want to react to shootings. We want to deal with the whole child. We want to deal with the whole mental and what it's like. Let me tell you something. If people are shooting at me, it's going to cause a lot of mental problems. So they need to shut all that down. I'll be interested to see what happens after this on whether SROs quietly come back into their school districts. Or they may turn around and say, well, we have armed security, which I'm sure they do. But again, they're not receiving the kind of training. And also another part that really bothered me is how they said, we don't want to just turn these kids over to the cops. And they actually said in this presentation that is online, they said, you know, we have an agreement now with Denver Police Department that some of these low-level crimes, we're just going to handle within and not even call the cops. Really? Is that their job to not report crime? Are they saying that the Denver Public Schools is in the business of not reporting crime? Interesting.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, the other part is the training. What type of training do you provide to dean of students regarding, you know, how to properly
patting down?
How do you properly pat down? What do you do in the event that there is a weapon? What do you do in the event that a weapon is presented? What is the course of action? What is in your standard operating procedures of how you deal with this? And if you have armed security, why isn't armed security dealing with that particular piece as opposed to dean of students? Because you're not only putting the dean of students in potential harm's way, you're putting the entire school in harm's way. Because I can assure you that, you know, when this student engaged, he wasn't concerned about where that bullet was going. He was, however many rounds he fired, the bottom line is he put other people in harm's way. And now it's going to be, you know, if I was a parent there at Denver East, I'd be asking, you know, some very hard questions. Like, what are you guys doing? What is going on here? Because I think you're
going to let a student.
Yeah, I think you're going to find out.
In my school.
Yeah.
That needed to be patted down every day. And you didn't tell us.
Right. And how many of these students are there? Like, are we talking about a group of students that you know of that are potentially armed and you're just patting them down? That makes no sense. None of this makes sense. And, you know, like you said, hopefully these two administrators, you know, come out okay. And more importantly, that there's some positive, you know, direction taken as a result of this, and that it can't be a faculty member who's doing a pat down. Just like, you know, I know there's probably a large debate about faculty members carrying weapons. I mean, you know, that's a whole nother thing where, you know, if they're not trained, what are we exposing the kids to potentially, right? So, you know, I don't want to get into this whole you should have a gun, you shouldn't have a gun. The reality is law enforcement is designed to protect, right? To serve and protect. If they're going to serve and protect, put them in the schools, allow them to protect that school, because we found, right? What did we learn from Columbine? We learned that, you know, there, if it wasn't for, you know, Neil Gardner, Deputy Gardner, not being there in the first couple minutes of the shooting, that there probably would have been a lot more kids hurt. If we didn't learn what happened at the STEM shooting, where a young kid was killed there, there was an armed security guy that engaged. If we didn't learn anything from the shooting in Bailey and some of these other shootings around just our own state, is that when you have a presence of law enforcement, you have the ability to react and respond in a very quick time. And to add to that, Mark, I don't know if you knew this, but the paramedics were actually working with a kid on campus who was having an allergic reaction. And if they were not there, who knows where these two administrators would be right now? I mean, they were able to provide immediate medical attention to these two individuals who were shot, which, you know, could have saved their lives, probably did save their life. And that goes to why you need law enforcement on campuses. I mean, this is not, if we haven't learned anything from all the school shootings around the country, we should learn that, you know, Uvalde, I mean, in that poor shooting, law enforcement officers who didn't even go in.
Didn't even engage,
you know? So, you know, now we're asking, now we're asking deans of students and faculty members to go in and be the person to, you know, to take these weapons away from them, to do the pat downs. That's just, it's crazy. It's crazy talk.
It is crazy talk. And again, I mean, it's wrong on so many different levels. You know, that you're asking a dean of students to do this. Why wasn't, well, of course, there's not going to be an SRO there because they got rid of them. Right. But why wasn't armed security there every time? And plus, did the student, I want to learn more about how this actually worked. It sounded to me like this, it was up to the student to go into the school, go to the office and say, pat me down. I mean, what? And you know, they're so lucky, and we'll probably find out and hear more about this in the future. You know, after he shoots two people, he doesn't care at this point. He just shot two grownups.
Right.
So as he's walking out of the school, running out of the school or whatever, why didn't he shoot a bunch of students and other faculty on his way out?
Right.
You know, so they may have been very lucky. And I hate to say that, and we pray for the two that were injured, but they may have been extraordinarily lucky that maybe the gun jammed or, you know, something happened, because I don't understand why he didn't shoot his way out, so to speak, but it could have been a lot worse.
Yes.
And so I wonder if the school board is going to be recalled by parents that are furious. And like they say, you know, politics doesn't have a lot to do when it comes to protecting our kids. Right. You know, so you could have massive parents saying, how dare you let somebody back into our schools that needed to be patted down as a safety plan? That's insane. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more about all of this, especially, you know, because I used to be on a school board and I'm definitely interested in security. It was under my watch being on the school board that we brought in armed security to our school district. And we never had a conversation of, do we not want to have school resource officers at our schools? Our response was, we wish we could afford to put them in every school all the time. You know, so it was quite the opposite conversation that we had, because we understood the only way you stop someone with a gun is typically with someone with a gun. So, but it is.
What, you know, they talked to a few of the kids there. You know, I was reading a couple of things, and, you know, they all said, you know, it's supposed to be the safest place that you can go to. And what we're finding out is that, you know, schools and churches and things like, you know, places like that are becoming more and more, you know, stressful to go to. And, you know, our kids already have enough to worry about. Now we have to worry about their safety. And here's the thing, not only do they have to worry about their safety, but now they don't even have somebody there to provide safety in the event that something was crazy.
What do you do?
Yeah, you got two kids shot prior to this. Like, what is that tipping point where you go, okay, we've had one kid shot in the face, one kid who's been murdered. Now we have two administrators that have been shot. So when are we going to bring in law enforcement? Like, what? At what point do you bring in law enforcement?
I, I'd be interested to see if somebody on the school board says, well, how come Denver Police Department had such a slow response time to our school? Well, their response time would have been awesome if there was actually an SRO inside the school. Yeah. So that's going to be, you know, it almost to me, it's like that San Francisco person who's like, where are all the cops at now? Well, you defunded them. I mean, this isn't rocket science, but even you'll find churches that are arming individuals, retired cops and stuff that attend those churches because they know that an armed presence is what it takes. But and any last minute things about school safety, and then we'll kind of move on. I could talk forever on our next subject.
Yeah, tragic deal. And, you know, we're going to see what comes of this now, you know, how the school board responds. We'll see.
Oh, they're going to try to push it back on somebody else. I mean, instead of taking responsibility and saying, okay, we tried this, this isn't a good plan. But I mean, the bottom line is if you say that your SROs are racist, I mean, if I was Denver PD, I'd say, really? You know, if you think we're all racist, why do you want us back? But we'll see how that plays out. I mean, give them a chance to live and learn and understand their mistakes. So now kind of moving on to the criminal justice system. If you want, I call the whole system that, but I really want to, instead of the whole criminal justice, judicial.
Okay.
You know, we've learned a lot. You and I have participated in numerous criminal trials, many of which were homicide trials, all different kinds of sex assault trials, all kinds of stuff, both working as cops or detectives and investigators, whatever. And then now as experts working for criminal defense attorneys, there's been some things that I've noticed during my career that have always been like, huh. And one of the things I brought up earlier was the whole grand jury scenario. And I'm sure you could talk all day about how grand juries are rigged, because you know firsthand how a corrupt district attorney, Mark Hurlburt, not that I'm going to mention names, can manipulate a grand jury to indict someone for kidnapping who never even met the person. Couldn't pick them up in a lineup. But you can indict, and I know you don't want to talk about specific cases, but that's one of the things that hit me, and with the whole Terry Makeda case, is how a corrupt district attorney can get anybody indicted if they want, or not indict someone who should be indicted. As an example, down in El Paso County, two events, one was a Republican, one was a Democrat. They backed up. So they did illegal backing in a lane of traffic, ran over someone and killed them. One a Democrat, one a Republican. Democrat is charged. Republican was not charged because it was a Republican DA. So my biggest issue is, for the system to work right, you have to have people that their conscience is dictating that they're trying to do the right thing, and politics and everything else is out, you know, trying. But I think we kind of give too much power to district attorneys because they do have the decision to prosecute felonies or let them go.
Right. I mean, you know, personally, Mark, I think the only way to minimize this is to hold them accountable. And the only way to hold them accountable is to not give them absolute immunity.
Right.
You think about it, right? A doctor, if they make a mistake, they can be sued, right? If they operate on the wrong leg or, you know, do something wrong and during their operation or their medical practice, they're held accountable. If a lawyer doesn't do something right, right? They can be held accountable for it. If a builder, an engineer constructs something wrong, they're held accountable. The electrician doesn't wire a house right and it catches on fire, they're held accountable. How is it that a prosecutor can indict somebody or charge somebody with a crime and know full well that there is not an ounce of evidence to support those charges, and yet they go through it and then there's no accountability? They what they end up doing, right, is they end up dropping the charges in the 11th hour. Right. Or in some cases, they take it all the way to trial and say, you know what? What happens is what happens. If they end up getting convicted, they end up getting convicted. Right. And that is the problem with the system. The system is designed to really support the people. What I mean by that is the government. And it was never, when you look at the criminal justice system, it was very specific that a prosecutor is supposed to seek justice Well, what is justice? Like you said, right? It's not just it's an ethical and a moral compass, right? And when you're lacking that, and you use that power to go after people because either they're on the other side of the aisle, or you know what, they don't look right today, or they had a bad day, so you know what, go out, or you know, they had a family member who had been sexually assaulted, so now all sex offenders are guilty. You can't have somebody like that in those kinds of positions. You have to have somebody who's more centered. Who's more centered and is looking for evidence. I mean, we've gone away now from looking at evidence as being a crucial piece of a case. I mean, I you know, again, not to give you specifics, but I helped a poor kid here. He went to the Air Force Academy. Okay. Goes to the Air Force Academy. He's in the top of his class. This was years ago. Top of his class, and he is charged with a sexual exploitation of a child. So it's basically having child pornography. Okay. So the defense attorney says, John, can you look at the case? And so I'm reviewing this case, and I'm like, I'm kind of like, what's wrong with this case? There's something wrong. And the attorney goes, what's wrong? And I go, I can't find any images or references to actual images of child pornography. And he goes, that's because there are no images of child pornography. So I asked them, wait a second. If there's no images of child pornography, how can you be charged with possessing child pornography? We actually went to trial, and you know, we had to put on the whole case, and it took the jury 5 minutes to come back with a not guilty verdict. But here's the kicker in the whole thing. That poor kid was charged with sexual exploitation of a child, was not given the opportunity to graduate with his Air Force Academy class. In fact, they offered him a non-commissioned position as opposed to a commissioned officer. So he lost everything. He'll never become an officer, right? He'll have to serve his deal as a non-commissioned officer. And then he's going to come out and he has that stigma of having somebody make an allegation that he possessed child pornography, even though there was not a single image of child pornography found by the government. And nobody was held accountable. Nobody was held accountable. So, I mean, again, right? If you're going to take somebody's, you know, rights, if you're going to take away their livelihood, at a minimum, you should be held accountable. If you know that it is wrong and you continue to go down the wrong path, that there should be some accountability and that you should not have absolute immunity. That's crazy.
Right. And I've run across the same thing as well. And I'd say probably we've been doing this for about 8 years since we retired. And I had a case down in Canyon City, same thing. Not that we only work on child pornography cases, but down in Canyon City, they had me review this case and come to find out they had no images.
Right.
And they never searched his computer. So I was just like, and I wrote this report up and said, they have no evidence. And as soon as we submitted that report, they dropped all the charges. And this brings up a thing that I always say is that law enforcement tends to take the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
So what they'll do, and this is very dangerous, if there's one thing we should talk about today, because we kind of wasted too much time, there's so many other things I'd like to talk about. But one of the things that I've definitely seen, it's probably one of the major issues, is a lack of a thorough digital investigation. So for me, my expertise is in digital forensics, cell phones, computers, call detail records, phone records, things like that. And John is more has that background, but he also has working crime scenes. So he's an expert on crime scene investigations as well on major cases. And we'll find that law enforcement will tend to take the path of least resistance. They'll do as little as they possibly can. And then the problem with that is you only have one chance to screw up an investigation. So if the cops go in and they're investigating someone who doesn't even know they're being investigated yet for whatever reason, they gather all the evidence that they think they need, and then they charge this person 6 months later. Then the defense attorney calls us in maybe a month or two later, asks us to review the case, and we'll say, whoa, we need to get this. We need to get these phone records. We need to, you know, to do this. And they don't exist anymore because the cops are the ones that had the opportunity to obtain the best evidence, best digital evidence, right. And they didn't. They didn't. It'd almost be like going to a homicide and saying, hey, guys, take a picture of that gun and just leave it there because we don't need that. We just need pictures of the murder weapon. That's not how it works. You take the gun, you sees it, you put it into evidence, and you make sure that it's always available for fingerprinting, DNA testing, ballistics, whatever. But when it comes to digital forensics, they're sloppy in a lot of these cases. And then we get involved and it's like, well, if we had this, it might have helped our case. So it is imperative that law enforcement don't look at it that once they suspect that this person is their suspect, that they don't focus all their efforts after this individual. They need to follow the evidence and get to the truth and follow up on leads, even though it's like, man, I just don't think that has anything to do with Johnny. You know, we know Johnny's the guy who did the shooting. This isn't going to help us prove Johnny, but it might lead to some evidence exculpatory showing that he maybe didn't do this, but they don't care. They're just focused on the person that they think did it. Right. And because of that, it can cause a lot of problems in trying to defend people.
Well, and the problem is that barrier, right? That probable cause is such a low barrier, whereas beyond a reasonable doubt is at such a higher level, right? So you have this probable cause. And, you know, unfortunately, the government doesn't need much more than that. There's a lot of case law to support, right? That all you need is probable cause. And so, you know, I just give you another example of a case, and this is another unfortunate deal. A student had a crush on a teacher that was married and had kids. And this student wanted to, you know, be that teacher's, you know, for lack of a better word, a girlfriend. Okay. And teacher kept, you know, dismissing it and saying, you know, no, you know, I can't do that. You know, I'm your teacher. And, you know, the student then made allegations that the teacher touched her and that there was communication between the two of them. Well, the teacher, right? Because again, he's, you know, he's not getting involved with this. Just the mere allegation of this, Mark, initiated an investigation. And don't get me wrong, if there are teachers that are doing something wrong, absolutely should initiate an investigation.
Right.
But my point is, you need to first gather the evidence. And when you don't do that and you just rely on a statement made by an alleged victim, then that teacher's life is now completely turned upside down because he'll never teach again, right? It's not like he can go to another state. They're going to Google him. They're going to find out that this particular teacher had some serious allegations about potentially a sexual assault on a child by one in the position of trust, which doesn't get worse than that, right? Doesn't get worse than that. And, you know, come to find out the student simply had a crush, and when he dismissed it, she wanted to get back at him, and she did. And that teacher lost not only his career, but was under a heavy investigation. And until that investigation was exhausted, he, you know, it was already too late. That ship had already sailed, and there was no coming back from it. And that, you know, again, that's the problem. So like you said, with digital evidence, if they had obtained some digital evidence, they probably would have been able to see initially that he had dismissed her. Look, I'm your teacher, right? No, this is not going to happen. But what ends up happening is none of that is seized. They take the statement of the student, which, you know what, you have to protect the student. I'm not in disagreement with that. But it's, what do you do after that? What did you do to gather evidence before you go out and make an arrest? And that's the part that never happened.
Right.
You know, it's broke.
And another thing, we've just got a few more minutes here. Is what I refer to as the infamous overcharging.
Mm-hmm. They use that as leverage.
And then cutting deals. So what you find is, you know, this guy will be arrested or whatever, and maybe he did do something wrong. Mm-hmm. So he did this one thing that was, you know, he broke the law. Right. And then all of a sudden law enforcement or the district attorney is adding 6, 7, 8, you know, multiple counts of the same charge. And then all of a sudden he's looking at a bazillion years in the state penitentiary. And he's like, well, wait a minute, you know, the original crime, which I did, you know, is like 2 to 6 years or something. But now all of a sudden, you know, I'm looking at 48 years for this crime.
Right.
Yeah. We got to take a deal, you know, and then all of a sudden they get jammed up because, as I always say, the odds are such that you can't risk, you know, if we try to fight this, you know, maybe they didn't do something completely wrong. I can't get the right scenario, but what they're charging them with, it's like, I didn't do that. I didn't do what they're charging me with, but I could do 48 years they're offering me, you know, 2-4 or whatever. I better just take that, because if I do go to trial and I lose, I could get 48 years.
Right.
And I've definitely seen that in some cases where it's like, you know, I get that maybe he should be charged with this and then let the jury decide on this 2-4 year business. But when you're looking at 48 years, they can't make a decision to challenge it because the risk is too high.
Yeah. But then if they do go to trial, here's the worst part of it, Mark, is that when they do go to trial and this person has maybe 8-10 charges, you got to remember just the psyche of the human. If you're sitting on that jury and you're looking at somebody who may have been charged with 8-10 charges, you almost feel like an obligation, right? To where, okay, I'm maybe not going to charge him with this, but there's no way he's going to walk on all 8 or 10 charges.
Right. There's no way that they charge.
I have to agree to a guilty verdict on at least
of
one
something.
Of something, exactly.
Of something. Because, I mean, the police don't arrest somebody for 8 counts or 8 charges
for nothing.
If they didn't do something.
That's correct.
And see, that's where you get in this whole system of where it's to the advantage for the district attorney to overcharge. And it's done typically, I think, more at the DA's office than at law enforcement, but I've seen it, you know, both ways.
Right.
And you know, I get it, but you need to be charging people appropriately. And I've also found this, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, is the DA and the defense attorneys, they talk. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, okay, so let's talk about this case. Are you looking at any deals? And they're having that conversation. And then the defense attorney will say, well, I hired this expert. And I've had this multiple times where defense attorneys have come back to me and said, Mark, I just got done talking with the district attorney. And I told them that I hired you as an expert to help me on this case. And they said, well, if you hired him, no deals. We'll go to trial.
Right.
She goes, I don't know where that's coming from. The fact that I'm trying to get an expert to tell me what kind of case I have when we're looking at the digital evidence or digital forensics, that's their obligation as a defense attorney to do that. They need to know how serious the digital evidence is against their client. So they hire me, and then all of a sudden the DA's like, well, no deals. And I've learned to respond back now and say, just wait. They all, you know, some of them say it at the beginning, but they're going to come back and say, okay, what's the deal? You know, what are we going to do?
I find a lot of it, and I know you're probably getting short on time, but I find a lot of it now has become more personal, right? It's not about
like a competition.
Yeah, it's not about justice. It's about wins, right? And wins versus losses. And it can't be that way when you're talking about people's lives. Look, if they did something wrong, they deserve whatever's coming their way. But if they didn't,
to be fair.
That's right.
But inconsistent.
Inconsistent, exactly. And the system is broke in many ways.
Right. So we've kind of run out of time. Unfortunately, I got this whole big list of other things that, you know, we've been involved in the last 8 years of doing this kind of stuff. We could go on forever about specific cases that we've worked on that have been adjudicated. But John, as always, I appreciate you coming and hanging out with me whenever I guest host for Chuck and Julie. And I hope Chuck and Julie are having a great time. I think they're flying back tomorrow. And everybody, you'll see them on Friday, and I'm sure they're going to have a lot of cool things to talk about with the whole President Trump thing and all that other stuff. But hopefully in the future, we'll guest host again, and John and I can kind of finish this conversation, maybe some other cases. There's always something that comes up and happens. So everybody have a great day. Look forward to Friday. Chuck and Julie will be back.